The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program Telia Klebanov-Jacobs. She joined us on the telephone in the Boston area. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are the co-author of a new book called Stealing Time. You wrote this with Norman Birnbach. And I understand that he's the one that kind of had the original seed that sprouted up into this story. Tell us how this happened.
So Norman and his daughter were out at, I believe it was a diner. This was quite a few years ago. And the diner had a rotary phone. It was either a rotary phone or a, you know, punch phone, push button phone. And she had never used one before. And she thought that it would be kind of cool to call her brothers at home and say, hey, here I am using a, you know, push button or rotary phone, and she did not know how to use it. He had to talk her through it. And that was when he realized that his bright, adventurous teenage daughter would have had real trouble navigating the New York City of his youth, which was in the 1980s. And he and she just started talking about it and tossing ideas around, and it turned into, you know, one of those family conversations. And then when he and I got ready to write our first book together, he pitched the idea to me, and there was so much there to like. And he combined it with a jewelry heist that was actually based on a real jewelry heist, the 1964 Murph the Surf robbery of the American Museum of Natural History. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And I had already written a couple of crime novels, and so between the, yes, I too have teenagers and grew up in the 1980s, plus the crime aspect of it, I was absolutely sold.
I'm guessing that you wrote the parts featuring the criminals who were planning the heist?
Well, we both wrote lots of it and then edited each other's stuff. But, yeah, scenes of extreme criminality are much more mine than his. I think it's safe to say.
Okay. And explain the partnership between the two of you. What made you decide to write a book together?
COVID. In a word, COVID.
Oh.
So I was actually, this is my fourth book and Norman's first, although he had written a bunch of shorter things that had been published in various publications that have turned me down, like the New York Times and McSweeney's and so forth. And it was February of 2020, and I was starting to work on a fourth book. And then March happened, and everything shut down. And my family was trying to give me space to, you know, do my work. But, you know, we were all under one roof, and it just wasn't working. So I had contacted a friend of mine who teaches elementary school, and I said, hey, why don't you have your students generate a bunch of plot devices, you know, characters and settings and so forth, and I'll see if I can spin it into a story for them, because I thought I could use a deadline. I thought that would be helpful. So she did, and the kids came up with a bunch of very cool stuff, and I just couldn't get my head around it. It was the stress of those early days when everything was slamming shut and none of your plans were coming to fruition and you were just watching the death tolls rise. It was just so awful. I know I don't have to describe it to anyone who's listening. And right about that time, Norman contacted me and said, hey, because we had been somewhat in touch on social media, we had known each other very slightly in college. He was a couple years ahead of me, but we hadn't spoken for decades. And he contacted me through social media and said, hey, a mutual friend suggested that I ask you about critique groups for my writing. Do you know of any? And I did not, but we chatted a bit, and I said, so, you want to work on something together? And he said, sure. And so we wrote that story for my friend and her students. And my line is, this is like having a gym buddy, but for words. Mm-hmm. And then having found that we could, in fact, work together and you know, had the same work ethic and compatible senses of humor and various other things that I think are absolutely necessary for this kind of partnership, we decided to tackle something bigger. And that's how Stealing Time came about.
Did you say March happened? Did I hear that right?
Then March 2020, yeah.
Okay. So here we are in March 2025, and there are some amazing coincidences about our conversation today. Number one, you have this flashback in time back to the 1980s when everybody still had landlines, and you and I are talking on one of those rare primitive landlines that I love so much. Plus, today is St. Patrick's Day. This is really
it
amazing.
Is.
Yeah.
I know. I love it.
Because.
So should I explain why this is a coincidence?
Yeah. Let's go for it. You go ahead.
Okay. So in Stealing Time, the jewelry heist takes place on St. Patrick's Day of 1980. And the reason that we did that, and I should preface this by saying I did not grow up in New York, Norman did. And so for the New York-specific parts of the book, those all came from him. And so he knew that the city is basically paralyzed on St. Patrick's Day because there's a huge parade and everybody becomes apparently about 5,000 times more Irish than the Irish themselves. And the idea that you could, you know, get a car through the streets with any kind of alacrity is apparently just not a thing. And so it was his idea to have the crooks use the holiday and all the holiday activities as perfect cover for breaking into the museum and stealing the gems that are there.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Telia Klebanov-Jacobs. She's the co-author with Norman Birnbach of Stealing Time. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. As the book opens, it is 2020, the year that the pandemic hit. It's just hitting right as this story opens, and our protagonist, Tori, which is short for Victoria, is a teenager, and she's in her apartment in New York City, and then something weird happens.
Yeah, something very weird. So her parents are on the verge of divorce, and she has a pretty terrible relationship with her father because he's this grumpy, depressive guy. And as she is packing up to leave because she and her mom are going to hightail it to the Boston area, a reporter calls and asks to speak to her father. And because the conversation is on speakerphone, she hears the reporter say things like, so it's the 40th anniversary of the jewelry heist, and what about your father? And, you know, what about your mother? And she's like, well, what is this all about? And she is 15 years old at the start of this story and does what any modern teenager would do. She Googles it and discovers that her grandfather, her father's father, whom she never met because he died before she was born, was incarcerated in the early 80s for stealing a huge yellow diamond called the Desert Sun. And pretty much as she makes this discovery, she and her dad have the latest in a series of big blow-up arguments. She runs into her room, flops down on the bed, is looking at a picture of the Desert Sun on her phone, and then becomes refracted, like blown into a mist.
Mm-hmm.
And a moment later sits up on the bed, sort of shaking her head and saying, wow, what was that even? And a boy is standing in the doorway looking at her and saying, what are you doing in my bedroom? And she eventually realizes that it is his bedroom because although it's the same apartment, it's 40 years earlier It's March 1980. It's a couple of days before the jewelry heist, and that boy staring at her from the doorway is, in fact, her own father.
I love that.
Yeah, that was all Norman's idea.
That is so cool. And you just take off from there. And we're back
and we take off from there.
We're back in 1980, and mm-hmm. she's meeting her grandfather, Victor, for the very first time, and she's seeing her grandmother, who she thinks of as this very unwell elderly woman, and she's seeing what she was like 40 years before. This is just so much fun. You really had a good time with this, didn't you?
We really did. And part of why we chose 1980 specifically is that although it's technologically very different from today, you know, if you think about smartphones and the internet and the fact that if you have a smartphone, your back pocket contains more computer power than NASA did when they sent astronauts to the moon. Yeah, it's just really kind of boggling. But that being said, the 1980s were very culturally similar to the 2020s in a lot of ways. If you think of, you know, the kind of music and the way kids dress and so on and so forth, I actually feel like there was a lot more of a generation gap between, say, you know, my parents and me when I was growing up. You know, they grew up listening to big band music.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, we wanted to point out a lot of differences, like the reason that Tori's grandmother is, in fact, so frail in 2020 is that she has emphysema and she's hooked up to an oxygen tank, which is the result of a lifetime of smoking. Well, in 1980, I think it may have been over half of American adults smoked. I mean, it was just astonishingly common. My high school even had a place to go to for the kids to smoke. Like, oh, you're having a nic fit, go over there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just staggering now, having seen my own kids through high school at this point. The idea that you would provide a place for them to smoke it doesn't happen anymore.
I'm sure we have listeners out there who remember 1980 very well and what the world was like then. And you have a couple of things in there that I personally connected with, because in 1980, I was managing a record store and I also was a music DJ on the radio. So you have them go in this record store and they're looking at the album covers and you don't even say whose record it is. And I'm like, I know what that record was. And then a little later, the father, as the child, is talking about how on Sunday nights he would listen to the Dr. Demento show. And I used to program the Dr. Demento show on radio back in 1980. I was just like, wow, Dr. Demento. I mean, who brings that up? And you've got all these period references throughout the book. They're like little gems scattered among the pages.
Oh, thank you so much. That's exactly the effect we're going for. So I'm so glad it worked. And yeah, we decided to have Tori and Bobby visit a record store, and yeah, Glass Houses, the Billy Joel album.
Mm-hmm.
God bless the internet, because we found out that album came out two or three days before our story starts. So it was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And in the record store, and as you know, Tori convinces her dad to buy it for himself.
Yeah, I love that. And the interactions, because she has to admit to the boy that, well, I have to tell you, I'm a time traveler and you are my dad. And then they end up getting another person involved in this, and this is his friend, and they have to tell her. And so they form this trio of people that are aware that she's there from 40 years before. And because she has this dysfunctional relationship with her father, the exploration of her relationship with her father as another adolescent is just so ripe for fun. You just have such a great time with their interactions.
Well, thank you so much. And again, it's such a delight to hear this, because this is exactly what we were going for. We wanted to have Tori and, well, in 2020 his name is Bob, so we changed it to Bobby in 1980, but we wanted them to be able to meet as peers and get to know each other as peers. and have that really inform the way Tori sees her grown father, because she finds herself getting to be friends with Bobby and continually thinking, wait a minute, how did this, you know, smart, funny, you know, loyal, kind guy turn into the grump I know from my own life? What went wrong?
Mm.
And there were, when Norman pitched this idea to me, there were two things that really made me want to do it beyond the plot elements I've already mentioned. One was, he said, do you remember when you figured out that your parents were people? And I did. And it was, you know, somewhere in the high school years.
Mm.
And then the other thing was, because in, we can call it timeline A, Victor goes to jail for a few years. This has a huge effect on Bobby, who turns into Bob. And when Norman was describing to me, I said, I tell you what appeals to me about this. You're talking about the long-term effects of incarceration on the children of incarcerated parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention that I used to teach writing classes in Massachusetts state prisons. And a lot of my students were parents. And I will tell you that not only are inmates invisible to society, but really nobody cares what happens to their kids. And I'm not saying that, you know, everybody who is incarcerated is innocent or anything like that, but I am saying that this has a lifelong effect on their kids. And some of it is the stuff you would expect, like they're more likely to use drugs, they're more likely to become incarcerated themselves, you know, be mm-hmm. part of the criminal justice system. But then there's a whole ton of stuff nobody ever thinks of, like they're less likely to go to summer camp. Which might not sound like a big deal, but it's one less thing they have in common with their peers. They get less sleep than their peers, on average. They get lower grades. They get lower test scores. You know, they are more likely to become socially isolated. They have fewer friends in childhood, which usually translates to fewer friends in adulthood. And this was what we saw happening to Bobby as he grew up as a result of his dad's imprisonment and conviction. And you never see that discussed.
Mm.
It is such a niche concern. You don't see it discussed in popular culture, or even, it's just not a mainstream concern. And I said, this is really something that I already know a little bit about, and I wanted to look at what we could do with a character who starts off very sympathetic, like Bobby, and turns into somebody pretty cranky, like Bob, as an adult, and say, okay, what exactly happened here? And I don't think we beat people over the head with it. We're trying to thread that needle of being, you know, clear but not playing whack-a-mole. But I think we make our point, and I'm pretty pleased with that, along with, as you mentioned, the heavy sprinkling of 80s references. A lot of people who are adults now who grew up during that time period have told us, as you did, that they really, really loved going back, as it were, and saying, oh, yeah, record stores. Oh, yeah, everybody smoked.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow, people wore fur coats. That was a thing.
Oh, wow, everything is covered with graffiti in New York City. My guest is Stealing Time's co-author, Telia Klebanov-Jacobs. She wrote it with Norman Birnbach. And one thing, you just referred to timeline A. And, of course, Tori, before she goes back in time and she's able to access Google and she's not walking around with a phone that is like a weird curiosity that doesn't work because she's 40 years ahead of it and there's nowhere for it to work, she, of course, wants to do something to maybe change time and the history of what happened, and her grandfather, who she never met, who's been accused of stealing this jewel and sent to prison. And so timeline A is what exists in time that she came from. Timeline B is what she's living now, and Bobby is a big Star Trek fan. And in Star Trek, we have some episodes where they're in a situation where they go back in time and they're like, well, are we allowed to alter something and make the outcome different? Are we allowed to do this? This is a deep philosophical conundrum.
Yes, and I actually watched several of those Star Trek episodes in preparation for writing this book. I think I got all of the time travel Star Trek episodes, and I was thinking maybe we could, you know, reference some of the dialogue about slingshotting around the sun or something that Spock recommends to get them back to their own time. But yes, in most timeline fiction that I know of, there is this huge question of if what will change in the future I came from if I affect something in the past where I now find myself. I don't remember the name of the episode, but when they go back to Earth just before World War II, and there's a sort of soup kitchen being run by a pacifist who's very an anti-war activist, and they discover that basically they find that if she does not die, then she prevents the U.S. from entering World War II, and Hitler wins.
Oh, right.
Which, you know, leaves you with a real conundrum.
Yeah. Well, I picked up on these things, and the humor in this, there's so much humor, which is really great as a reader. It keeps you so interested in the story and the interactions between the two of them. And I think one of my favorite scenes, I have fond memories of being in third grade and the nuns giving us cartridge pens and teaching us how to write in cursive. And you have a situation where Tori is supposed to write a note, and she – this is so funny. I love this.
Thank you. I wrote that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have to write a note, and she's writing because print is slower than cursive, and Bobby realizes that she doesn't have handwriting, cursive handwriting. They have a whole argument about it because she's used to keyboarding everything or most things. And yes, and it's in the middle of a very dire situation where you would think they would maybe not be squabbling, and yet here we are. And I'm so glad you thought that was funny, because I did too.
I loved it. And the criminals. Let's talk about these criminals, because they're an interesting group.
Okay, so the inspiration was a mid-60s robbery of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And the guy who led that robbery was named Jack Roland Murphy. But he was an amateur surfer. Maybe he was semi-professional. So his nickname was Murph the Surf, Murph Murphy. And one day in the mid-60s, he and a bunch of his friends were visiting New York, and they glanced up at the museum and noticed, I'm not making this up, by the way, this bit I'm about to tell you, that every night the museum staff would prop open the windows to the Hall of Gems to air out the exhibits. And so Murph and his friends decided that the museum was just badly in need of being robbed. And they, you know, scaled up. At that time, the Hall of Gems was up on the fourth floor, and they basically scaled the side of the building and got in. And there were alarms, but all of them were broken, and so none of them went off, and there were guards, but I think there were only two of them for the entire museum complex, which, if you've ever been there, you know, is just enormous. Museum security in that day and age was hysterically funny. So anyway, they got away with it, but because they were not actually criminal masterminds, I mean, this was really more like, you know, Bill and Ted rob a museum, they were actually caught very quickly, and a lot of the gems were recovered. Many of them were not and still have not been. And as a matter of fact, that episode is why the museum now has the Hall of Gems on the first floor with no windows. But anyway, so we knew that story. And we decided to not duplicate the gang. We wanted to make it more diverse. And so we had a female gang leader. And instead of Murph the Surf, she's a surfer, but her name is Maeve, so she's Maeve the Wave. Mm-hmm. They all come from Florida, and there are four of them. Three women and one guy who's an ex-Navy SEAL. And they are, you know, beach bums, surfers, and whenever money runs short, they'll rob a hotel room or three in the area. And they come up to New York thinking that they can market a line of surfing swimwear that they have developed. And nobody's interested because they're really not that impressive. They're, you know, a bunch of surfers, and every one of them has a rap sheet and so on and so forth. So they're really just not getting anywhere. And their feeling is, well, we can't go back to Florida in defeat. That's not happening. So we've got to pull off a score, and maybe when we get back, we can lie to everybody and say that, you know, we were successful. And that's how they decide to rob the museum with the aid of a friend of theirs who is a native New Yorker and knows the layout better. And I have to say, I'm glad you like them, because it was tremendous fun. Mm-hmm. Writing these people. They have a goal, and they're not, in a way they're good at it, but the pressures of pulling off a heist of this size start to crack them apart, and some of the interactions are really funny, and I'm hoping some of them come across as dramatic, because we did want that mix.
I think you accomplished that. My guest has been Telia Klebanov-Jacobs. She's the co-author with Norman Birnbach of Stealing Time. And this is such a fun read, and it has a wonderful ending. And I kept waiting to see how you would end it, because I thought, okay, is this going to be one of these books where I'm really entertained, and then at the end I just kind of go, meh, that didn't work for me. But this really works. And I loved it. I think it's brilliant, and I so appreciate you taking time to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me, and people have told us the ending makes them cry because it was so satisfying. I just want to say Stealing Time is available wherever books are sold.
The book, again, is Stealing Time by Telia Klebanov-Jacobs and Norman Birnbach. And the two of you knew each other at Oberlin. Is that where you went?
Yep.
Okay. A great school.
Good Ohio School.
Good Ohio School. You got it. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and The Book Nook comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 and every Sunday morning at 10:30. And we have over 1,100 interviews archived at WYSO.org. You can listen to them anytime you please. And for The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. And Telia, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real delight.
You're listening to your public radio station, WYSO. Stay tuned.